This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Winter Sisters by Robin Oliveira. Read for you by Tavia Gilbert. For girls and women everywhere. Book 1. Chapter 1. 2 days before Emma and Claire O'Donnell disappeared, a light snow fell from the dawn sky above Albany, New York, almost as a warning mist. Later, people would recall that the flakes were mistakenly perceived as a lark, a last dusting in what had been an unusually cold winter. The year 1879 was already proving to be a surprising one. On March 3rd, the first woman lawyer had argued a case before the Supreme Court, and despite the wretched cold, there had been an abnormally scant snowfall, just a foot since November, which had then melted away on 3 strangely warm days in early February, though the thick ice on the Hudson River had not yet broken. Emma and Claire O'Donnell were 10 and 7 years old, respectively. In concession to the snow, they wore boots, but because the day was already warming, they donned only a light coat over their spring dresses. Their parents were similarly attired, boots in lieu of lighter leather shoes, a woolen coat for Bonnie, a thin cloth work jacket for David. The O'Donnells lived in 3 rooms on the first floor of a row house on Elm Street. Every morning they left the house together, Emma and Claire for the Van Zandt Grammar School, Bonnie to her millinery shop on State Street, and David to the lumber district. Their farewell on the morning of March 10th at the school doors was unremarkable as farewells go. A brief wave, an affectionate reminder for Emma to take care of Claire, and noisy reluctance from the sisters, for it was annoying to have to go inside on such a splendid day. There was little reason, any of them believed, to mark the occasion. They would see one another at home for their midday meal, as they always did. David and Bonnie walked on together through the light, powdery snow, the 5 blocks to State Street, Albany's wide boulevard, which was graced at its summit by the new Capitol building, still unfinished after 12 years of construction. It was modeled after the Louvre Palace in Paris, but its outer walls had only just been completed, giving it a faintly apologetic mien, as its facade was still missing a promised grand stairway and a plethora of decorative friezes and gargoyles. Its interior 3rd and 4th floors were still barren hollows of scaffolding and echo. The exasperated legislature, tired of waiting, had preemptively moved into the 2nd, anticipating years of noise and headache ahead. The businesses of importance, with the exception of lumber and railroading, proceeded apace below the Capitol, on State Street. A languorous hill, it eased from the Capitol Heights down to the Hudson River, spanned here by 2 railroad bridges, 1 north and 1 south. The waterway had first been named the North River by the Dutch, because it allowed passage northward from the Manhattan Harbor, but it had long since been renamed after its discoverer, though the early moniker persisted in Manhattan City, whose centric gaze rarely extended to the wider world. Albany's principal economic engine was that it offered a decent port on the only navigable river a steamboat day's voyage from the bustling trade center. A stubborn Flemish perseverance had long characterized the city's public personality, which had sustained the founding Dutch through the threat of native unrest, the encroaching French, and finally the conquering English, who captured New Netherlands, essentially all of Northeast America, in 1664, and renamed the inauspiciously named yet tenacious city of Beverwyck, Albany. That same perseverance had also sustained the city through year after year of seasonal floods, for though the river was an economic boon, It was also Albany's watery Achilles heel. But today, Monday, March 10th, it was snowing, and the river was still frozen, and merchants, bankers, printers, engravers, tobacconists, reporters, druggists, lawyers, and one milliner were all converging on State Street to empty mousetraps, sweep refuse from thresholds, and deposit money into their empty tills. The mercantile neighbors waxed convivial with one another about the snow shower. Smiles all around, and a shaking of heads. Albany. David O'Donnell accompanied Bonnie to her shop at 59 State Street, as he did every morning. His pride at her success was exceeded only by his pride in his daughters, Emma and Claire. Though if pressed, he might confess a partiality toward Emma, whose stubborn-spiritedness he encouraged perhaps more than he ought. But the pressing thing now was the snow drifting lightly from the skies, and the question of whether or not it had been advisable to have erected the new awning over the mullioned shop window. Under too much accumulation of the white stuff, it would founder. But as they assessed the sky for clues, a patch of blue opened above the river, settling the issue. David kissed Bonnie's cheek, and taking his leave, descended the slippery sidewalk toward Broadway on his way to the lumber district, where his work as a stevedore had shaped his strong body into an anvil.
"You'll not forget dinner tonight at the Sutters," Bonnie called after him. "I mean the Stips."
After 12 years, she still couldn't get it straight. Her beloved adopted family had grown. No one in the city of Albany knew whether to call them the Sutters or the Stips either. The O'Donnells were generally believed to be their blood relations, though that was not true, even as much as Bonnie wished it were.
"And if you stop for a pint on the way home," she threatened, "don't bother to come calling. I'll bolt the door against you."
Turning, David raised his arm in salute, a teasing grin skittering across his weathered face.
"Dinner?" he said. "What dinner?"
"David O'Donnell, it's your fault, you know, that Emma is such a scrapper."
But Bonnie stood under her green-striped awning and admired the man as he sauntered away. David was her second husband. Her first husband, Jake Miles, had disappeared in the War of the Rebellion, and none too glad had she been to see him gone. For a brief time, she'd been in love with Christian Sutter, Amelia's only son, but he had died early in the war. And then David had spotted her on the street one day, and made a pest of himself until she fell in love with him. He had given her Emma and Claire, whom she cherished. She crossed herself to honor the two children she'd had with Jake. They had died as infants, a sadness from her unlucky past. And she made a last cross to honor Elizabeth Fall, Amelia Sutter's grandchild, whom she loved just as much as she loved her own daughters, and whom she missed, for the brilliant girl had gone with her grandmother far away to Paris to study violin at the conservatory there. Bonnie was worried about her. Lately, Elizabeth's letters had confided great sadness.
6 o'clock! Remember!" Bonnie called after her husband.
After turning and waving, David cut down Montgomery and dashed across the tangle of railroad tracks at Spencer, then followed Water Street into the lumber district, crossing the narrow lock bridge that separated the terminus of the Erie Canal from the Port Basin. A sudden, sharp gust of wind chilled the 2,000 laborers pouring into the 50 lumber yards on the 100-acre island, carved between the Erie Canal and the Hudson. David worked for Garrett Vanderveer, the preeminent lumber baron in the city. Garrett S. Vanderveer, it could be said, ruled Albany. Advertisements for his white pine shone down from nearly every brick building lining the grand commercial boulevards of Western Avenue and State Street. "The best white pine in the world is at Vanderveer and Son Lumber." While Vanderveer was a fair employer, His temper could rage when things went wrong. This year, an unanticipated excess inventory of milled white pine had wintered over, and Van der Veer wanted to ship it the minute the frozen river opened to navigation, which he believed would be soon. His overseer, James Harley, a more reasonable man, nonetheless shouted over the rising gusts to the assembled 100 laborers of Van der Veer Lumber that this morning's first task was to clear the accumulating snow from the stacks. So David and the other longshoremen climbed the towers of plywood and joists and 4x4s and got to work. In their classroom at the Van Zandt Grammar School, Emma and Claire were seated 2 rows apart. They had been gazing out the windows at the snow, which was beginning to turn heavier. But Emma, the oldest, sighed and exchanged a despairing glance with Claire before turning her attention back to their teacher, a recent graduate of the State Normal School, who was teaching some complicated math to the older students. Claire studied Emma from the corner of her eye. It pleased Claire that people said they looked alike, with their cascades of copper hair and bright blue eyes. But that was where their resemblance ended, Claire believed. Emma was so much more clever than she was. As Emma leaned over her paper to solve a raft of division problems, Claire pretended to do the same, but instead, she was secretly thinking about the party that night at the Stips. 5 long blocks away, Bonnie was contemplating the party, too. It was their annual celebration of the opening of her shop. This year was the 6th, and it was she who ought to be hosting since Amelia Sutter was away with Elizabeth in Paris, but Mary Stipp had insisted on continuing the annual tradition of hosting the party at their home, even in the absence of her mother and niece. It was Amelia who had provided the initial funds. Bonnie had repaid her debt long ago, but the party had become a celebration, not only of Amelia's generosity, but of the family's long friendship, close ties, and remade lives. And then there was the fact that Mary Sutter Stipp had delivered both Emma and Claire, and one of her babies from Jake, who had died. Their tight bonds could never be broken. Outside, the light dimmed as the fluffy flakes turned beady and began to pour from the sky. Casting a wary eye toward the window, Bonnie resolved to leave her shop earlier than she usually did to pick up the cake at Mariano's bakery for tonight, but she wasn't really worried. It was March, after all, nearly spring. The snow had to let up soon, and she had work to do. She finished dusting her showcase and arranging her work table, permitting herself a small smile of self-congratulation as she sat down to put the last touches on the hat she had been decorating for her best customer, Viola Van der Veer, the wife of Garrett Van der Veer, David's employer, and the richest man in Albany. Not that long ago, was it really 20 years, Bonnie had been an ignorant farm girl, and now she was making hats for a woman whose patronage had ensured her success. Because when Viola Van der Veer wanted something, the rest of Albany society did too. Not so much out of affection for her, but as a mark of financial equality. That collective desire had provided for, among other things, the excess funds to purchase the cherished awning. Despite the snow, Bonnie expected that Mrs. Van der Veer might stop in today, as she often did, to chat with her as she worked. The society woman's loneliness had come as a revelation, especially given Mrs. Van der Veer's standing in the community, which recently Bonnie had learned Mrs. Van der Veer considered more a chore than a position she prized. Mostly, Bonnie was honored to be the recipient of Mrs. Van der Veer's sometimes mournful confidences, and more than once she had offered the tearful woman her shoulder. The new wide-brimmed garden hat, a style that would set to advantage Mrs. Van der Veer's tiny figure, was already laden with white egret plumage and exuberant silk peonies. Bonnie marveled at how her customers seemed oblivious of her tricks. All she had to do was juxtapose a pair of complementary colors, offer the surprise of a new pattern, or more importantly, disclose which of a client's friends, or enemies, had purchased a far superior quality of velvet, and the sale was done. In Albany society, Bonnie had learned, superiority mattered. Hard won, reaped with unsheathed claws and an enigmatic smile in ballrooms and dining rooms across the city, who was the business of those women? And if she, a former farm girl, provided ammunition to the struggle, then all the better. She paused and took stock. The addition of a hummingbird would finish the hat well. It was an embellishment that Viola Vanderveer loved, and Bonnie often finished her hats with that signature detail. Now she tested first one, then another of the featherlight birds, setting them in a tiny nest of straw, choosing, finally, a ruby-throated one, its wings aflight. Bonnie was still holding it up to admire when a violent burst of wind pushed open the door and the iridescent bird flew out of her fingers and up toward the ceiling. So much snow was suddenly spilling from the skies that she could hardly see a thing. She fumbled for matches to light the gas jet, but a curtain of darkness had fallen. The snowfall was no longer a mere sprinkling, a last reflexive fit of winter. It was a blizzard. Bonnie instantly thought of Claire and Emma. Would they shut the schools for a storm this foul, or keep the children instead? It didn't matter. She would go get them. Unthinking, she jammed Viola Vanderveer's unfinished hat on her head and fled outside, pulling on her thin coat. Instantly, the churning wind spun her around. She regained her balance and bent low, taking first one step, then another, into the maelstrom. In the lumber district, James Harley, the overseer, hollered above the roar of wind for everyone to get out. Hearing Harley's cries, David leaped to the ground from the top of the stack he'd been clearing and headed toward the lock bridge with hundreds of his fellow laborers, each one doubting his ability to find his way home in the sudden whiteout. Despite growing panic, the men worked together, linking arms and edging across the narrow lock bridge, made hazardous by the accumulating snow. The snail-like pace of escape was excruciating. When it was finally his turn, David bowed his head and shuffled across, praying not to be blown into the canal. But once he successfully negotiated the bridge, it soon became impossible to know what was ground and what was sky. Gravity lied. Senses failed. By blessed dumb luck, David navigated the 12 long blocks back to State Street, staying to the lee of the buildings and marking his path by memory, his collar turned up against the frigid cold. He blundered on, finally reaching State Street, where he traveled perhaps a dozen steps up the sidewalk before he lost his sense of direction and veered into the street. The blinded driver of a heavily laden dray never saw him, nor did he grasp that the cry he heard and the sudden jolt of his sliding wheels meant that he had crushed a man. A few steps away, Bonnie heard a man's cry, but was in too much trouble to help. In the blinding conditions, she had turned right when she should have turned left, and left when she should have turned right, and since leaving her shop had traveled only in circles. She lunged toward the cry and tumbled into a pillowy drift from which she struggled in vain to free herself. In Emma and Claire's schoolroom, wild bullets of snow were striking the window, terrifying Claire, who searched for the comforting vision of Emma in the rising darkness. Their young school teacher interrupted her lesson on long division to kneel and shovel more coal into the stove, a fractious, unreliable thing she had battled all winter. A burst of air whistled down the updraft, sending a cloud of ash into her face. The soot would dirty her face for 3 days, but the children would be too frightened to enjoy the comic spectacle. The teacher managed to relight the fire and distract the 15 children in her care with books until she could no longer outshout the howling wind. Day passed into late afternoon and then evening, and the school's principal raided the cupboards, but found only a tin of crackers to serve all three classrooms. No parents arrived, and so the children and their teachers slept in a huddle around their classroom stoves, blanketed by the thin outer garments they'd worn that morning. Drifts buried the flues on the roof, and exhaust backed into the classrooms. Woozy, the principal, acting on instinct and little else, stumbled down the hallway in the darkness and cracked open the front door of the schoolhouse, saving them all from asphyxiation, but not from the poor judgment and illness the odorless fumes induced. Throughout the next day, Tuesday, as the storm continued to rage, children and teachers alike vomited and shuffled about, poisoned, but alive. On Wednesday at noon, when the storm finally abated and a sheen of brilliant light flooded the city, the befuddled principal spilled 45 poorly dressed and sickened children into 5 feet of glittering, blinding snow. Their frantic parents had bolted from their homes the second the snow tapered off, and now they waded through enormous drifts to reach their children, whose befogged minds were clearing in the fresh air. Child after child was scooped into welcoming arms, but no one claimed Emma and Claire. Stunned by the cold, the two girls shivered on the iceberg of snow blown up against the school steps, until Emma took hold of Claire's hand and forged a mountain goat path over frozen drifts in the direction of their home. Just about the time that Emma and Claire started out, the doctors Mary and William Stipp, in their home a mile away on Madison Avenue, discovered that the blizzard had buried the doors, making egress to the wide veranda or the backyard impossible. After some consideration, they dropped to their waists into the deep snow from their parlor window instead. Outfitted in woolen hats, thick gloves and coats, wide mufflers and lined boots, fitting attire for the daunting task ahead, they were nonetheless unprepared for the breathtaking cold. The air crackled. They blinked and pulled their mufflers above their noses. Mary wore a pair of William's flannel pants, cinched up by one of his wide belts, a new hole punched into it by a scalpel. At 40 years of age, Mary Sutter Stipp was much younger than her husband. They'd met during the War of the Rebellion at the Union Hotel Hospital in Washington City, where William had hired her as a nurse. He taught her as much medicine as he could, falling in love with her in the process. Separated in the middle of the war, they lost track of one another. Mary went on to medical school. It wasn't until afterward, in 1867, when William had given up hope of ever finding her, that they found one another again. They had married soon after, because time was a thief, he'd said, and he needed her more than he needed air. William knew it was said in alehouses around town, where men gathered to talk like that, that Mary Stipp was taller and larger boned than was considered attractive, but the opinions of idiots mattered not one whit to him. Mary exuded an intelligence and determination he'd found intoxicating, as did most anyone who met her. Prematurely silver-haired, frank, and, to him, lovely, Mary Sutter had been persuaded to become Mary Stipp, to his everlasting gratitude. For his part, William Stipp had long passed the age when dropping out of windows into drifts would have been considered a good idea. 63 years old, he was not as nimble as he had once been, though he managed to keep them both from falling as they turned to get their bearings. Ramrod straight, he had aged in the 14 years since the war, as many other veterans had, exposed to punishing years outside in the elements. His face bore the deep lines of the stress of that cataclysm, as well as the exposure. When the storm arrived, they had been seeing patients. William in his clinic in a converted downstairs bedchamber, Mary in the dining room, a sunny, windowed cloister that overlooked the back garden. Their well-appointed but plainly furnished parlor served as their waiting room, where from dawn till evening, a crowd of tired shop girls and ill-dressed factory workers corralled their hordes of restless children and waited for their turn with the famous woman doctor. William's patients, crippled veterans complaining of their ill-fitting wooden legs, factory workers hobbled by various ailments, men and women suffering complex fractures, bided their time on the lower stairs or milled about in the wide foyer. Despite the home's location on the relative outskirts of the city, the horse car line went past every half hour. The morning the blizzard began, when the bright light spilling through the east-facing windows had darkened into night, furious whispers of panic had arisen. The doctors consulted. They would allow no one to leave. Thus, for the last 50 hours, 7 women, 9 children, and 5 men had been the Stips' unexpected guests, bedding down on the divans and floors and exam tables, sharing blankets, and in the case of at least 1 man and woman, a noisy conjoining that had unnerved everyone. Now everyone was hungry. The grand dinner of roast beef and Brussels sprouts and pudding they had planned for the O'Donnells had barely stretched to feed everyone that first night. Their patients then exhausted the pantry and consumed every last potato in the root cellar, to say nothing of decimating the stores of butter and milk. They had finished all the bread, too. Mary and William were leaving Harold Bloom, their driver, in charge. Bloom, a wiry man with a thin twig of a mustache, was paid to be ready at any hour and could harness a horse faster than anyone. Married to Vera, a gruff Russian immigrant of immense proportions, the two lived above the carriage house. Vera's English was poor, but she was as flexible as her husband, producing meals at all hours without question, unless there was no food to be had. She leaned out the window now to remind her employers to find butter, eggs, and salted meat, and to not forget milk for the children. Behind her, Harold's face was knotted in worry.
"Be careful! And now I'm shutting this accursed window before we all freeze to death!"
Confronted with a white wilderness, William and Mary calculated the effort it might take to reach an open store, if any were open at all. None had yet been established this high on the hill, with the exception of a butcher on Lark Street. Already Mary's toes burned from the cold. It seemed madness to push on, but they needed food. And they were worried about the O'Donnells, who would have been separated when the storm began. David in the district, Bonnie at her shop, the children at their school. They feared that the children may have been let out of school to fend for themselves at home. And so they plunged into the blank, bristling quiet, holding hands, William forging a path through the high snow one step at a time. They were already winded when they reached the street, but they pressed on. Their home bordered Washington Park. In the deadened landscape surrounding it, only the Stips moved. Drifts splashed up against trees, inundated house porches, and buried wagons abandoned at the onset of the storm. They sidestepped down the hill of Madison Avenue toward downtown, alternately hurt and helped by gravity. In the lee of some buildings, the snow was a manageable 2 or 3 feet deep, and here and there paths had already been cut, but in the middle of the avenue, the drifts reached the unscalable height of 8 feet. Still, even keeping to the sheltered side of the street, it took them a good hour to reach Elm Street. Normally a lively residential lane, in the aftermath of the storm it was a deserted wasteland, though here too a sleigh had cut through the shallowest depths. At the O'Donnells, William climbed adrift to the frosted windows of their front room and banged, leaving off only to peer in, his gloved hands cupped around his eyes. The upstairs residents hollered at them through their unopened window that none of the O'Donnells had returned home. Concerned, Mary and William then trudged the several blocks to the Van Zandt school, where they found the doors bolted shut, the school empty. Here, more paths had been trodden through the drifts, and they followed one winding trail toward State Street. Along Eagle Street, not a single shop had opened, but in the window of the Oyster House, one candle burned a small yellow hole in ferns of frost. They went inside and huddled next to a glowing coal stove. The Stips thawed and dried their wet gloves and wolfed down a plate of cheese and crackers and mugs of beer in lieu of real food. The restaurateur lived in two rooms above and bemoaned the fate of his expensive daily shipment of oysters from Manhattan City, fearing the bivalves frozen in some stranded rail car. The clock rang three, and William paid an exorbitant sum for the man's last wheel of Vermont cheddar and four tins of crackers, which he obligingly packed into burlap bags. Thus provisioned, they headed again into the biting cold. More people had ventured into the white void on foraging missions of their own. Mary and William tramped block by block toward Bonnie's shop, which they had seen from afar had been stripped of its awning. A wedge of snow 3 feet high had forced the door open, and inside a crystal white carpet blanketed the floor. Scattered hummingbirds, dyed feathers, spools of ribbon and lace were half buried and strewn about, but balanced on the trim above the mullioned window, a single ruby-throated hummingbird flew above it all. Mary and William waded into the back storeroom, tamping down a rising panic, hoping to find Bonnie wrapped against the cold in a roll of velvet or gingham. No snow had penetrated the small room, but Bonnie was not there. At the sound of a strangled cry from the street, they dropped their bags and rushed outside. A man had fallen to his knees at the edge of a towering drift, from which protruded a single hand. He and William bent to the task, using bent forearms to sweep aside the dry crystals, which flew back into their faces and bleached their eyebrows and mustaches. Together, they uncovered first an arm, then a torso, then a garden hat, and finally Bonnie, face down and lifeless, clad in nothing but her soft-spun day dress and one shoe. William pulled her from the drift and cradled her in his arms. Mary sank to her knees beside them and touched Bonnie's glaciated face, which was icy blue with cold. Snow clotted her curls, and her eyes stared, unseeing. They carried her corpse to the coroner's office, where Dr. Starkweather would spend the next few days batting away the black humor that attended the confluence of his name and the devastation of the storm. He led them down a steep stairway to a makeshift morgue in the basement, where sandbags already buttressed its street-level windows against snowmelt, and makeshift beds of plywood and sawhorses already bore a dozen unidentified bodies. Notes pinned to their clothes indicated the location of their discovery. They laid Bonnie down on an empty slab and reluctantly turned their attention to the others. Even for William and Mary, veterans of the War of the Rebellion, the sight of David's battered body brought them both to their knees. A quick examination revealed a head injury and a broken leg. The cold would obscure any internal injury he had likely suffered, but they took no comfort that he would not have survived the accident, blizzard or no. "Have any children been brought in?" Mary said, making a second rapid turn of the room. "In another room, maybe. Somewhere? Our friends have... had two children. We've been looking for them. They weren't at home. They weren't at school." The city physician was a laconic man, grown unimpressed with death in his years as coroner, but his red-rimmed eyes softened.
No one's brought in any children yet.
Two little girls. Red hair. Blue eyes. If someone... Starkweather touched Mary's hand.
I'll send for you. But more than likely, they'll turn up somewhere safe and sound. They were at school when the blizzard came?
Yes.
Then a friend might have taken them in when no one came for them. A thousand things could have happened. Your friends.
He nodded toward Bonnie and David.
That's terrible luck. But it's unlikely to befall their children as well.
The Stips dragged themselves home in the pale light of a rising gibbous moon. They had completely forgotten about the cheese and crackers they'd left at Bonnie's shop. Upon hearing they'd have nothing to eat, their ravenous patients wrapped their children in borrowed socks and hats and blankets and dropped one by one out the parlor window and made for home. Before the parlor fire, thawing their hands over cups of hot water, Mary and William reassured themselves. Dr. Starkweather was of course right. The girl's teacher or one of their friends would know where they were. And when they found them, they would break the terrible news of their parents' deaths and give them a home with them. Bonnie and David would want them to.
Ought we to telegraph Amelia and Elizabeth?
William said. Lately, he'd grown worried about their niece, Elizabeth, who had written to him every week from Paris, but whose letters had recently carried a vague, distant tone. He considered Elizabeth his daughter, and had, since Thomas' fall, her father had died. William's face, with its landscape of deep hollows and high crests, was always a reflection of the implacable severity of his war years. But now the firelight, his grief, and thoughts of Elizabeth deepened every crevice. I don't think so, Mary said. Not yet. We ought to spare them as much pain as we can. Let's wait until we know something more. It was impossible to get warm. They went to bed. William cradled Mary as he had cradled Bonnie. And after a while, she stopped shivering. Chapter 2. The O'Donnells were not related to the Sutters and Stips, but their ties went just as deep. Theirs was a familiar, if convoluted, story in a nation that had of late known too much death. 14 years since the end of the War of the Rebellion, and the nation was still counting the dead. 600,000? 800,000? An estimate only. And the toll among the civilians who had starved would go unsung forever. In the wake of the devastation, new families had been formed by tenuous ties. Cousins distant and more distant banded together. Sad widows married even sadder widowers. Brothers and uncles and aunts and friends and orphans clung to one another to assuage their enduring pain. The Sutter family's story of change began when the war did. In 1861, the Sutters took in the then Bonnie Miles after her second baby with her first husband, Jake Miles, died. Later, after Mary's fraternal twin sister, Jenny, died giving birth to Elizabeth, it was Bonnie who mothered Elizabeth in Jenny's place, even after Elizabeth's father, Thomas Fall, returned from the war. In 1863, they all moved to Manhattan City so that Mary could study medicine with Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman to graduate from medical school in America. They all continued to live together in Manhattan, in the same house, even after the war, even after Mary married William. The two families separated only when Bonnie married David. Then, a few years later, both families moved back to Albany. The weight of this deep and enduring bond pressed on Mary and William the next morning as they ventured out again, following the path that they had forged the previous day. The city was already coming back to life. Many people were daring the cold, shoveling great mounds of snow. but mostly accomplishing only a rearrangement of the white stuff. Frustrated, people set bonfires in an attempt to melt it quickly, but that succeeded only in creating lakes of ice too treacherous to negotiate. A few businesses had opened. Enterprising chestnut roasters had fired up their braziers and were doling out small rations in paper cones for a penny. A dry goods store shuttered the day before was doing brisk business in sacks of flour and cakes of butter. A baker had shoveled his sidewalk early in the morning and was proffering hot rolls. Mary and William bought both rolls and chestnuts and consumed them standing on a corner before pressing on to Elm Street, where they knocked on the doors of David and Bonnie's neighbors and had the same conversation again and again. "We're looking for Emma and Claire O'Donnell. Did you happen to see where they went?" "No. Didn't Bonnie or David retrieve them from school?" Sharing the sorrowful news was exhausting when they had not yet become reconciled to it themselves. And not one of their neighbors knew where the sisters were, or even that they were missing. Those who had gone to the school recalled seeing Emma and Claire at the school doors, waiting. Surely someone else had realized they were alone and taken them home? Try the Atkins. Try the McIntyres. Try the Brunos. But neither the Atkins, nor the McIntyres, nor the Brunos, nor anyone else knew where they were. People joined in. By mid-afternoon, an army was knocking on doors on all the side streets to no avail. Though they did learn that the principal, who had forded 2 miles of drifts to her home in North Albany, had been admitted to City Hospital with frostbite. "No," the principal said, her eyes widening with confusion and horror. "No, it can't be. I checked the whole school. No one was left behind, no one." On the hope that perhaps the girls may have been admitted too, Mary and William swept through the hospital, looking for them. They searched St. Peter's Hospital and Child's Hospital on Hawk Street, to no avail. "Emma and Claire," their young teacher said at her rented room on Eagle Street. "They're missing?" And at the morgue, an exhausted Dr. Starkweather, now presiding over 20 bodies, shook his head.
"Not yet, but they're still coming in."
That night, Mary and William tried again to reassure themselves that little girls didn't just disappear. But they would soon learn that the storm had devastated the whole of the Northeast, not just Albany. The official count of the dead would total 400, with thousands more injured, and 100 unaccounted for. In Albany, 23 people died, and 5 had gone missing, among them Emma and Claire. By the next morning, their driver, Harold, had managed to dig out their sleigh from the carriage house, and he drove them to the police station on Dove Street, located several blocks from the former Sutter home. The precinct house seemed to be in the process of disintegrating. The dull red bricks emanated a shabby weariness that cast a deep pall on the otherwise well-kept neighborhood. Until now, Mary had never once had cause to visit the station, and the narrow vestibule, where little daylight penetrated, did nothing to dispel an impression of suffocating gloom. A lanky policeman hunched at the front desk, a kerosene lantern flaring on a hook above his head, its sooty ghost smoked into the wall. No gas jets burned in this hulking building, for it was too old for such modern conveniences. Inside, it was so cold that you could see your breath.
"Missing, eh?"
Officer Colum Farrell's accent was thick Irish, a product, no doubt, of his Sixth Ward upbringing, where the Irish in Albany had lived since anyone could remember, and turned out policemen like a factory. Thin, fair-haired, and long-boned, he nonetheless gave the impression of uncommon physical strength, perhaps because of his square jaw and the large size of his hands. He listened to their panicked entreaties with patience and sympathy, soliciting clarification on timelines and the particulars of Emma's and Claire's appearances, and where they had last been seen. Dutifully, he took careful notes, and when he had exhausted his questions, said,
"They'll likely turn up. You'll see. But we'll be looking for them. You might want to give the orphanages a look on your own. It'll be faster." "What's this? Someone missing?"
came a voice from the hallway, in as thick an Irish accent as Farrell's. Captain Arthur Mantell was less burly than round, less tall than average. But his demeanor gave the impression of an angry bull, with a matching stance that appealed to Mary. He demurred from taking them back to his office for a private conversation, claiming that it was a death trap, piled about with sundry ledgers and papers, and too many guns to count.
"Orphans," he said, after hearing them out. "And you say no one's seen them? That's a shame."
"Yes," William said.
"What do you usually do in such a case?" "Keep a keen eye out. Ask the neighbors. But it's not quite the usual, is it, with the snow? And their names are Emma and Claire O'Donnell? You're certain now?"
His voice carried a measured curiosity, as if he were aware how even this routine question could elicit grief from a panicked citizen. "Why wouldn't we know their names?" Mary asked, incredulous. Mantell shook his head.
"No reason. Have no worries now. We'll be vigilant. Every police officer will get a copy of their descriptions. We'll ask at churches, orphanages. You can too. You've already shown good initiative. Keep it up. It can only help. But, I warn you, it's possible that they could have gotten confused in the cold and wandered in the direction of the river."
"Why would they have done that?" Mantell shrugged.
"Like I said, confusion. And then some rift in the ice could have swallowed them up. But that's the worst possible outcome. Keep heart. We'll search with every resource we have."
During the next 2 weeks, Mary and William braved the cold and snow and swept through the rest of the city's hospitals, posted notices, published a daily ad in all the newspapers, and toured the 7 orphan asylums multiple times, including 3 in Watervliet and Troy, their sleigh flying across the frozen Hudson at the marked crossing. One evening, William took the train to Troy and walked the streets with a lantern. Mary took the train to Schenectady and inquired at 12 churches and orphanages. At night, they curled into one another in bed, enervated, nearly broken, and carried on a variation of a single conversation, Mary always beginning, her mind mulling the inconsistencies. "The principal said she didn't dismiss them until the storm ended. They were so close to home. The sun was shining. They simply couldn't have gone into the river by mistake. Their school is too far from the river. None of that makes sense, William."
"They may have made it home and discovered that David and Bonnie weren't there. It's not out of the question that they could have wandered off looking for them. Attempted to go to the district,
but the neighbors said they didn't come home."
"They may have gone straight for Bonnie's shop or to the lumber district, misconstrued where the lock bridge was, ventured out onto the unstable ice. Just like the police think."
"But it's all such conjecture. And convenient. If the police decide Emma and Claire are dead, then they don't have to look for them anymore."
"But the girls aren't the only ones, Mary. Dozens of others, too. Gone without a trace."
His voice, that low, glorious growl that Mary loved, was grim with sorrow. From the moment she'd first seen him, at the beginning of the war, When she'd overheard him begging the nuns of the E Street Infirmary to send him a nurse, and she'd taken advantage of that need and shown up at the Union Hotel Hospital insisting he take her on, the deep tones of his distinctive voice had not only chastened and challenged her, but also validated the notion that her intelligence was more valuable than gold, and her unexpected presence in his life a blessed, lucky thing. And on one crucial day at Fairfax Station, when thousands of wounded Union soldiers lay on damp, hay-covered hills, needing an evacuation that seemingly could not be accomplished, his impatience and fury had illuminated the inversion that triage was not cruelty, but instead mercy, and that pity was not compassion, but instead a useless waste of time. Now he held her in his arms, and in that way they had of skipping 1,000 unnecessary words, read her mind.
"This isn't Fairfax," he said.
"But this isn't the war. People don't just disappear."
"They do if they've gone into the river."
"William."
"But where else could they be, Mary?"
"Where else, indeed?" At the end of those 2 weeks, Mary was certain that Captain Mantell had grown tired of her. She recognized the signs. The weary sigh of recognition, the overly polite greeting, the fathomless volume of platitudes lobbed in her direction. "How good to. I've been thinking of. I admire your..." She had called on him daily, and once again early on Monday, March 24th, after yet another fruitless weekend of searching. Out of necessity, William had reopened his clinic to patients, but Mary, they had decided, would go on looking. Or rather, Mary had decided. She would not let missing stand. She would look for Bonnie and David's children forever. "But there must be something else you can do," she implored Mantell now, ignoring the slightly disdainful turn of his lip. She noticed a faint smell of rum about him. She'd heard things, too. He lived in a far nicer house and had more money to spend than a police captain ought to. "Surely you can look harder. Surely there is some solution you haven't thought of yet."
"What more do you want me to do?"
There was a new, brittle edge to Mantell's voice.
"Pick up the cobblestones one by one and inspect their undersides? They're gone, madam. We have looked in every cranny of the city, just as you have. Most times, you'd been to a place even before we'd gotten there ourselves. There's nowhere else to look."
"That's not possible. There's always something else to be done."
"Listen to me. We kept watch for your young ones. We did. Stopped urchins on the street. You know, those ones that live in the hovels near the tracks and down by the gasworks? Asked after yours. We've done more than that. More than you can imagine. But if you don't mind my saying, madam, grief plays nasty tricks on people, especially when it's children that are perceived to be in trouble. I think it's time you come to terms. And if you cannot, you best head to Saratoga Springs to take a water cure, because you've gone out of your mind with grief. You've got to understand. You've got to believe it. They're gone, and no amount of anger at me is going to find them now."
Outside, Mary put a hand to the side of the brick building to steady herself. In the 12 years of her marriage to William, children had never come for them. As a substitute for their longing, they had instead lavished attention on Elizabeth, and on Emma and Claire, too. But now, Emma and Claire had vanished, and it seemed the river was the only explanation. Chapter 3 2 days later, At 4 o'clock in the afternoon on March 26th, in an apartment on the Rue de Rivoli in Paris, Amelia Sutter looked out an open casement window overlooking the Tuileries and the avenue below. A finely boned woman, she had grown slightly fleshy at the waist with age, and in this angled light, her face revealed deep lines earned by myriad decades working as a midwife. Amelia considered herself very fortunate. She had rented this high-ceilinged, wainscoted apartment from Elizabeth's former French teacher in Albany, Madame Hubbard, who was French and the wife of a former diplomat to Paris. Madame Hubbard was a practical woman who from time to time suspected her husband of infidelity, and she retained the apartment in case she one day felt compelled to return to the French capital, though she had readily leased it to Amelia a year and a half ago, when Elizabeth had auditioned for a place at the Paris Conservatoire. Recently, Elizabeth had implored her grandmother to let her travel to and from the conservatoire alone, and despite some trepidation, Amelia had conceded. As the mother of Mary Sutter Stipp, Amelia knew when to give in to an intrepid and stubborn young woman, though in Paris, as in Albany, young women ordinarily did not travel alone, and they certainly didn't take the omnibus alone. But, as Elizabeth herself had argued, she was a Sutter, or at least the daughter of a Sutter, and Sutter women had been driving themselves hither, thither, and yon for an eon. No adhering to societal expectations for Sutter women. Sutter women took care of themselves. Sutter women bore up at all times. And so, for the last few months, Amelia had awaited her granddaughter's return from her classes, not outside the tall double doors of the conservatoire at number 2 Rue Bergère, but at this window, enjoying a cup of tea, admiring the beautiful view, and reading Le Figaro, the premier Parisian newspaper, to improve her French. But she was uneasy today, and had been for some time. It wasn't because they hadn't heard yet from Mary or Bonnie, since news of the great northeastern blizzard had reached Paris. The mails and telegraph were said to be down, and only essential communications were being transmitted. It was instead because, despite Elizabeth's daily protestations of well-being, Amelia had lately detected a new disquiet in the girl. Certainly, Elizabeth no longer seemed the self-assured prodigy she had been at the end of October 1877, when they had traveled to Paris for her audition. At 15, she had stood alone on the stage of the conservatory's U-shaped performance hall, the first of its kind in the world, and widely celebrated for its sublime acoustics, and played Viotti's complex violin concerto No. 17 in D minor, with confidence and verve, earning unanimous high marks, and immediate entry to Charles Girard's vigilant instruction. A faculty member, he was the most famous violinist in France, some might say infamous, and brilliant besides, but he was also exacting. Gradually, over the year and a half under his charge, Elizabeth had stopped practicing as much, an unsettling development, and she had not been sleeping well either. And though on Sunday she had played with distinction in one of the periodic public concerts in which only the most gifted students performed, and had earned a standing ovation for her solo, afterward at home Elizabeth had turned critical of her performance, dissolved into tears, and slammed the door of her room. It sometimes occurred to Amelia that perhaps Bonnie should have accompanied Elizabeth to Paris instead. Elizabeth adored Bonnie and shared confidences with her, and Bonnie's pride in Elizabeth's prodigious talents pleased the girl the most. But of course Bonnie had her own family and her millinery shop to take care of. Amelia took a sip of tea, thinking through the problem of Elizabeth's unhappiness. Perhaps a leave of absence was in order, or a holiday. They could travel to Italy or Nice, where the girl could sort herself out. Elizabeth had grown so temperamental that it was often hard to know how to put things. But she would offer the prospect of time away anyway, because something had to be done. There was a brief tap at the outer door, and within a moment the housemaid, Flavie,